Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Joe Cirincione. He's a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and former head of the Plowshares Fund, and his books include Bomb Scare and Nuclear Nightmares. And to learn more about his work, you can go to Quincy Inst. That's Quincy, Q-U-I-N-C-Y, I-N-S-T, QuincyInst.org. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 4 p.m. Pacific, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Though the Russian ground invasion of Ukraine has progressed much more slowly than anyone, Vladimir Putin in particular, might have assumed, events still feel unpredictable. So rather than try to deal with the latest developments, I want to look at some of the issues raised by these acts of war and by local and international responses to them, what the context is, and what we can learn kind of to make sure that we're looking at this and moving forward wisely. And today we're going to look at nuclear weapons. As the world confronts the land and air attacks on Ukraine, perception and response is filtered through the knowledge that Putin and Russia possess nuclear weapons. Might he dare to use them? How should that possibility influence any military or diplomatic responses to the aggression? In fact, I think the biggest question might be, is it even possible to influence the behavior of a norm and law-defying despot who has nuclear weapons? So, today I turn to Joe Cirincione. Now, it turns out we last spoke in April 2017, approximately 5 years ago, and I looked back at that interview, and at that time, these were some headlines from the previous 4 days, April 2017. North Korea threatens to launch nuclear attack on Australia. China wants nuclear weapons eliminated in Korea. Nuclear-capable Russian bombers fly near U.S. to intimidate America. Group claims Iran is in full gear on covert work on nuclear weapons. Trump administration will review Iran nuclear deal despite compliance. And as we know, he later withdrew the U.S. from that agreement. And finally, UN voices fears of catastrophic nuclear accident as global tensions increase. Okay, that's April 2017. And the recent headlines now, mid-March 2022, Vladimir Putin's nuclear weapons already transformed the Ukraine war. Putin announces Russia's nuclear forces on special combat readiness status. Iran nuclear talks on pause in Vienna after Russian demand. Could Russia use tactical nuclear weapons? Nuclear war within the realm of possibility, UN Secretary General warns. What North Korea wants from recent weapon tests. And India calls missiles safe after accidental launching. So that's where we stand today. Joseph Cirincione, distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, previously served, as I said, as president of the Plowshares Fund. He was also Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress and Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Welcome, Joe, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Great. And let me tell listeners, we are recording this conversation Thursday, March 17th. As I think you know, Joe, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and ideas that we talk about. So I'm going to ask you sort of a two or three part question here. First, remind us again how you first chose to focus on nuclear weapons.
Well,
and
you know,
then,
I didn't.
And then a little bit about your recent path. reflecting on your years at Plowshares and what went into your decision to leave.
Wow, thank you. Well, I didn't intend to spend my entire professional life dealing with the worst weapons humanity has ever invented, but that's what happened. You know, I sort of started off as a community organizer in low-income housing projects in Massachusetts. And then which is where I met my wife, got married, had our first kid, and decided to retool by coming down to Georgetown University and doing their master's program. And I never left. I met people in part of the program. I got my first job in the Reagan administration. We got my first security clearance, and that led to work on the House Armed Services Committee. And I stayed in the Congress for 10 years. And that's where I really learned, you know, both how a bill becomes a law, really, and all about nuclear weapons. That was my brief that I was assigned, missile defense systems, NATO policy, all these things. I toured the world. I ended up in Berlin the week the wall fell down and saw that tremendous geopolitical transformation taking place. And then I left Congress and went to the think tank world and headed up major programs at these various Washington think tanks, then became a philanthropist at Plowshares for 12 years. And by the time I reached 70, I decided that was it. I just didn't want to work anymore. I didn't want to run staffs anymore. I didn't want to direct projects. I didn't want to try to get people to just do what I wanted them to do. And I stepped back and decided I would write, and affiliated with the Quincy Institute, which as president of Plowshares, I had helped start with donations and pulling together donors to fund that institute. And I was very critical of the think tank world in Washington. I feel that it's basically sold out over the last 20 or 30 years by taking corporate and government funding that tends to mute many of its criticisms of government programs, particularly defense contractors have learned from the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry how to flood think tanks with grants to mute any criticisms of their programs. And Quincy is different. Quincy's independent, doesn't take corporate or government or donations, doesn't take money from the defense industry, and is trying to promote a policy of restraint, to rely more on diplomacy to meet the national security and international challenges we face, rather than relying on the hammer of military force.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say two things in response to that last comments. One is, I recall going back, it seems to me, as far as the Obama administration, with the notion that like to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, to the fact that the U.S. had become overly reliant on the military response to any situation, and that I think one of Clinton's big tasks in state was to try to restore the diplomacy in the state, and the State Department, and obviously that fell back greatly, I would imagine, under Trump. Can fill me in here, but I'm right here that this was a long-term trend that attempted to be corrected, then slipped back. Where are we now in terms of the State Department and diplomacy's health?
Yeah, well, two figures can tell you the whole story. The State Department budget is under $40 billion a year. The Pentagon's budget is getting very close to $800 billion a year. So, you know, that should tell you how effective the Obama or Hillary Clinton efforts were to restore diplomacy as our leading instrument of foreign policy.
Yeah, yeah. The second thing I was going to say is what you said about think tanks becoming donor focused, if you will, and beginning to rely really on corporate donations and so on. During that same period, and probably even longer, the same thing has happened to universities, right? As I assume you know, public universities used to be taxes and tuition paid for public universities. Now, It's much, much more reliant on corporate funds. So here we have think tanks and academia both catering to their funders in terms of what they're willing to investigate and what they're willing to say.
That's exactly right. And you can look at, for example, the flood of Saudi money that poured into Washington and universities over the last 30 years. And that has resulted directly in the lack of criticism about the Saudi autocracy. When we talk about dictators in the world, we hardly ever talk about the Gulf dictators. And of course, when the defense industry and the government, the defense, Department of Defense, started funding institutes at both at universities and at independent think tanks, you saw a complete drop-off of criticism of military policies, which is one of the reasons I think the war in Afghanistan went on for so long with so little criticism, why the invasion of Iraq was greeted so enthusiastically in Washington, and the occupation, again, was subject to very little criticism, or the military budget. I mean, I remember when Brookings Institution used to do an alternative nuclear budget almost every year. You used to get independent investigations of the weapon systems. You just don't see that anymore. It's not just that. It's not that they're necessarily pro-military or pro-big budget, although there's some of that. Is that they just don't look at it anymore. And where they do investigate, you know, you see studies like how the military can preserve its technological edge and the challenges of Asia, things like that. You know, they're acting more like RAND than like really independent stewards of the public's interest.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hadn't even thought about getting into that issue in this interview, Joe, and so we won't, but
just as an aside that sort of sets the tone and helps you understand. It's part of the atmosphere in Washington that sort of led to the global war on terrorism and the lack of criticism about it and the use of military as a tool for geopolitical transformation that sort of set a standard that then Vladimir Putin thought, well, I can play that game.
Yeah.
I know how to do this. If the U.S. can invade Iraq to change a regime and make false allegations of nuclear weapons, well, I can do the same for Ukraine.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't justify what Putin is doing. It's just that we opened up that space. We said, well, here's how superpowers act in the world today, which is basically we can do whatever we want against whomever we want. And Putin said, well, I can too. The problem, of course, is that he's not the United States. He doesn't have the alliance system of the United States. And he doesn't, as it turns out, have the military capability to implement such a strategy.
Right, right, right. Yes, I recall, you know, and it was a question I was going to ask you at some point, was how that voice in the back of my head that keeps saying, what about Iraq, Terrence? You know, when we hear the condemnations of what's going on in the Ukraine, and I remember, if I'm not mistaken, that we were told, just as he has been told, this is against international law. This is not sanctioned by the UN. You know, exactly the same sorts of things. And as you and I have said offline, it doesn't mean any less condemnation of what Putin is doing and the tragedies and the costs and all of that to say that we did a very similar thing in Iraq.
Right, exactly. If and when we get out of this war without massive destruction, and we'll talk about that in a second, we got to have a deep look at our policies of the last 20 years and examine what we did right and what we did wrong, and whether we missed opportunities to prevent, one, a country like Russia invading a country like Ukraine, two, allowing a person like Vladimir Putin to have 6,000 nuclear weapons, and three, whether they're the things we could have done better when we enjoyed our unipolar moment.
Yes.
Did we squander the opportunity by thinking this allowed us to do whatever we wanted rather than it was giving us an opportunity to clearly set international norms, international law, international standards, so that when we're not the most powerful country in the world, we will have established structures that can protect us through the rest of this century.
Right. In other words, what happened after World War II in the setting the framework that was to go on for years after that, a similar reassessment and reconfirmation could well have taken place after the fall of the Soviet Union, and I think we'd all be better off had it.
Exactly. Exactly right.
So one thing I wanted to do is, of course, Ukraine and Russia are the focus of our consciousness about nuclear weapons right now. But because I have you, and when I looked back at that 2017 interview and so on, let's set the big picture first before we focus on Russia and Ukraine. Okay? Just check in on where nuclear weapons stand kind of in the world. So which countries have them?
Yeah. Okay, we'll start with the sort of the big picture and the good news. We're much better off than we were at the height of the Cold War, when in the mid-80s, when I started working these issues, we had 66,000 nuclear weapons in the world, most held by the United States and the then Soviet Union. And thanks to the policies of liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, but mostly Ronald Reagan, we started negotiating treaties that eliminated these weapons, just took them off, perfectly good working weapons. We took them offline, destroyed them, and we slashed the arsenals by 50% in the late 1980s, by 50% again under George H.W. Bush, and surprisingly by 50% again under George W. Bush. And all this meant that we're now down to a world where instead of 66,000, we have about 13,000 nuclear weapons, again, most held by the United States and Russia, with countries with a few hundred weapons, accounting for the other sort of about 1,000 of the weapons in the world. And those are roughly in order of their stockpiles. Let's see if I can do this right. France, which has got about 350 nuclear weapons. China, which has about the same amount. The United Kingdom, which comes in, I think, around 225. I'm doing this from memory. Mm-hmm. India and Pakistan have about 160 each. And then you have Israel, which has about 90 nuclear weapons. And finally, North Korea, which we believe has about 20 nuclear weapons. It's a little unclear. And that's it. Okay. And that's the mix. Yep. And then knocking on the door, there's good news there, too. You know, when John F. Kennedy worried in the early 1960s about proliferation, he worried about 20 or 30 countries getting these weapons. Well, now we're really down to one. Iran. Mm-hmm. And if we can solve Iran, you know, we can solve not just the regional problem, preventing other countries in the region from getting nuclear weapons, but maybe open a pathway for walking back North Korea's program. And if you can do that, you know, using that same diplomatic model of shrinking a program, containing it, working over time to eliminate it, that's what the Iran deal tries to do. Maybe you can do that with North Korea. If you can do that, then you can really start looking at the end of proliferation, the end of countries who are aggressively seeking these weapons. That's the good news. The bad news is you still have 13,000 nuclear weapons, right, which is about, 50 times more than you need to blow up a human civilization. We roughly calculate that you'd need somewhere around 300 nuclear weapons to destroy all humanity has built up over the millennia. And those weapons could be used in an afternoon. Mm. At the push of a couple of buttons, you could end up in a global thermonuclear war that could use not just 200, but 2,000, 4,000 nuclear weapons. And that would be the end of humanity and the radiation of everything we now know.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that occurs to me as I was thinking about the contrast between now and 2017 is that perhaps, but I'd say one less unstable individual runs a country with nuclear weapons. But still, if you think about it, Putin, Kim Jong-un, Trump, that's a pretty high percentage of this.
I don't think, and you're just getting started there. I mean, what do you think about the leadership of China?
Exactly.
What do you think about the leadership of India?
I was going to say, not madmen, but certainly autocrats.
Right, or Pakistan,
yep.
You know, would Israel use a nuclear weapon? They threaten it a lot. You know, so it's, you realize, and it's crystallized around this Ukraine war, and you're realizing once again, and really for the first time, certainly since the the North Korea crisis that we talked about 5 years ago, the last time you and I talked, we were worried about Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump exchanging nuclear taunts. Remember?
Yeah.
Fire and fury.
Yeah.
Whose button is bigger? And in April of that year, we were of 2017, we thought we were coming close, but that crisis didn't involve actual combat. It didn't last that long. It was more rhetoric than actual engagement of forces. This is a war. This is, you know, thousands of troops, tens of thousands of troops engaged in combat, thousands of people getting killed on both sides now, and with a nuclear-armed power who integrates nuclear weapons into their conventional war plans. Every major exercise that Putin has done since he took office, so for a good 20 years, involves at some point testing out the use of nuclear weapons. The U.S., by the way, has the same sort of philosophy, integrating nuclear weapons into conventional war, but Putin just flaunts it and threatens it and couples it with threats. So now we're faced with this threatening situation, but it's not unique to Putin. It could happen in multiple scenarios around the world, but it highlights the risks we now have. How could it be that 30 years after the Cold War, Vladimir Putin has 6,000 nuclear weapons.
Right.
How can we allow these weapons to continue to exist to pose these kinds of threats? Those are the issues that come to the forefront for me.
And that weird correlation, at least, between autocratic and unstable leadership and nuclear weapons. As you went through those countries, it's more than half of the possessors of nuclear weapons are not people that you'd want to rely on, or not countries you'd want to rely on, given their current leadership.
Exactly. Or the leadership could change.
Yeah.
I mean, as ours
does.
I mean, nobody thought we'd ever have a person like Donald Trump with his finger on the nuclear button,
right.
But we did, and it might happen again.
Yeah.
And who's to say it won't happen in France or the UK, right?
Yeah.
And so what we're crystallized now by thinking, my God, is it true that the survival of human civilization is 30 minutes away from a Putin tantrum? Like, if Putin really is as unstable as some people think, would he really do this? Start a nuclear war? And could he do? And so, for me, the question is not will he, which is we don't really know. It's could he? And that we do know. And the answer is yes, he could. And that should be an unacceptable condition in the 21st century. Nobody should have the power to destroy the world.
Right. And what you're saying is when this is resolved, at least to an extent, I mean, who knows, quagmires can go on for years and years, as we have demonstrated in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when it's no longer a powder keg, at least, will the world's powers and the world, you know, be able to see this can happen again, and
that's
what
exactly
steps
right.
do we have to gradually begin to take to eliminate that possibility? You have said that both in print and I've listened to recent interviews, we are closer to the nuclear brink than we've been in many years, and you have a couple of reasons for that, one of which is obviously the situation we're in, but it also has to do with what you just said, which is that in the planning, in the wargaming, in the scenario, what you talk about is integrated deterrence. Talk about that.
Yeah, so this is a concept that both the United States and Russia have. And the idea is that we have to integrate all our deterrent tools, all our instruments of coercion, so that we can have a seamless continuum from economic threats, conventional war, cyber war, to nuclear war. And in so doing, the idea is we strengthen deterrence so that we would deter a foe from beginning a conflict with us because they could see that we would be willing to fight all the way up the escalatory ladder, as they say, and therefore they won't engage in the first place. And that's not a bad theory. I understand what they're trying to do. And for liberals who, for example, Colin Kahl, who's the Undersecretary of Policy for the Department of Defense right now, he talked about integrated deterrence in December, and he talks about it as a good good thing because we're expanding the toolbox. We're adding economic and diplomatic tools, not just a nuclear butt. The flip side is that when you do engage in a war, when deterrence fails, as it has in Ukraine, now you're on a very slippery slope. Now you've integrated all these things, not just in theory, but in exercises. We do it. The Russians do it. We brag about it. It's an integrated part. Nuclear weapons are integrated into the planning of the combatant commanders. All right? And this has all happened in the last 25 years. There used to be a cleaner break. Now there isn't. And so you realize that a war, especially if you start losing that war, the impulse is to escalate, is to go to the next level, like a gambler at the poker table who's losing a hand and decides he's just going to bet the house. He's got to win this hand. The difference is, if you lose at the table, you lose money. If you lose in this war, you could lose the planet.
Right, right. You have pointed out that the notion of a Putin or anyone with a weapon, I guess, the notion that you might have to show people you mean business, right? That's kind of, I think, where when we think about a scenario with what's going on in Ukraine right now, we've exposed the weakness of the conventional military, and folks believe that if NATO engaged, it would be highly unlikely that Russia could actually challenge NATO forces. But what does that mean? What's the bad news of that? The bad news of that is that Putin could end up feeling he's losing, feeling he's cornered, and then the use of what he calls a tactical weapon or something like that. And this is the Russians have a term for this, right? Which is escalate to de-escalate.
Yeah.
But as you point out, that's based on the notion that if you show your big fist, that the other side will back down. And what you say is that war games have shown that that isn't what happens.
Exactly. So this theory is in Russian doctrine. It's called escalate to de-escalate, or in some translations, escalate to terminate. And the idea is that if Russia is losing a conventional war that the West is involved with, they will use a nuclear weapon first to demonstrate the seriousness of the situation and to get the West to back off. And it could be a demonstration shot. It could be a strike at a military target. It doesn't have to be in theater. It doesn't mean that they would use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine. They could hit a U.S. military base somewhere. They could use a long-range weapon. There's nothing in the theory that limits it to battlefield nukes, as we say, shorter-range weapons. And the idea is the West would then back off. They would realize that Russia considers this war an existential threat, and they would sue for peace, etc., etc. The problem is when you sort of game that out, as we have repeatedly in war games, the West doesn't back off. Very often, the West will have a response in kind, as they say, and will meet that with an equal or greater nuclear counterattack. And then it just escalates. There is no logical termination point once a nuclear exchange begins, and it often goes all the way to global thermonuclear war. Not because people sort of intended to do that. They believe that their bluff or their demonstration of strength will work. It just, our exercises show that it doesn't.
Okay, let me tell people that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally speaking today with Joe Cirincione. He's a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's former head of the Plowshares Fund. His books include Bomb Scare, Nuclear Nightmares, and you can learn more about his work and his latest articles and interviews and so on at the site of Quincy Institute, and it is this. It is Quincy, Quincy, Inst, Inst. So it's the beginning of Quincy Institute. Quincy.org. Yeah, I mean, we've kind of laid it out. Let's talk just a little bit more. We're supplying Ukraine with military aid. What are we supplying, and what's the logic of what we're supplying and what we're not supplying?
Well, the U.S. is just the other day given $800 million of additional military aid to Ukraine. That makes almost $1 billion given just in the week that we're discussing this. And most of it is what we would call defensive armaments. So it ranges from small arms like shotguns and rifles to flak vests to helmets to equipment to radio equipment. But then we get into the more interesting stuff that appears to be having a tremendous impact on the Russian invasion force, and that is Javelin anti-tank missiles. And I'm very familiar with this weapon. The research on this started while I was still on the Armed Services Committee. The Stinger missiles, everybody knows what those are, but also stockpiles of Russian-made equipment like the SA-7, SA-8. These are man-portable is the phrase, man-portable anti-air weapons that have a longer range than the Stingers. And then this new generation of drones. There's something called the Switchblade drone, which is a very small drone, comes in a variety of sizes. It's fired from a mortar tube. So it's not the big, complex Predator drones that we were using in Afghanistan and Iraq that carry Hellfire missiles on them. This is a small, really single-use drone. They call it a kamikaze drone because it can be launched from a mortar tube, and the smaller version weighs about 30 pounds, and it can go dive directly into its target with this very small payload. The larger ones can weigh 300 pounds, also fired from a tube, and then go on and can loiter for an hour or more over the target until it finds the right one to hit. The Ukrainians appear to be using these weapons extremely effectively. Small groups going into the forest, hitting the sides of the Russian convoys, knocking out tanks, knocking out armored vehicles. The statistics are really stunning. Hundreds of tanks have been knocked out. The Ukrainians claim that they've killed almost 15,000 Russian forces.
Wow.
I know. The U.S. is about half of that. The U.S. intelligence estimates about 7,000, but all this is quite murky. It's not clear. Mm-hmm. But 7,000? That's how many Marines died in the assault on Iwo Jima. That's how many U.S. forces died in 20 years of combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. So to lose 7,000 soldiers, that's just the low estimate, in 3 weeks is an incredible figure. And just one more thing on this. We usually figure that a combat unit has lost its effectiveness if it takes 10% loss. So if you have 20 tanks and you lose two of them, even though you still have 18, they can't really function the way they're intended to function. Well, we believe that about 40% of the Russian forces have suffered losses of 10% or greater. So this is why this war is still going on, I would say at least 2 weeks longer than anybody thought it was going to. Everybody thought this was going to be over in days, including Putin. Well, it is not. And the Russian offensive appears to be stalled. And the Ukrainians, just in the last couple of days, have started to launch counteroffensives. So you might be faced with something that nobody thought was possible. Nobody thought it was possible that Russia would lose a war in Ukraine. But we're looking at I would say at this point, the likelihood of that. And that is what makes this such a dangerous situation, because as we just discussed,
yes,
if Putin feels he is losing this war, the risk of nuclear escalation increase.
And as you've pointed out, but I think many know, if Putin loses this war, he loses everything.
Yes.
All that he has built in terms of wealth, power, systems that he's in charge of, systems that he, you know, has domination over for 20 years, that all goes out the window if he loses this war.
Absolutely. And that's the flip side of the autocracy. I mean, this isn't a democratically elected leader. This is somebody that rules with an iron fist. He controls the oligarchs. You know, this isn't like a noble court who he has to woo and whose approval he needs. So if Russia loses, he loses. He is the state. And if he loses power, he could lose his life, and that is another factor that makes the nuclear threat so serious.
Yeah.
Because he will feel like he's got nothing to lose here, man. He might as well go escalate
and
see what happens. Go all in.
And one thing I wanted to mention, I'm sorry, I'm doubling back a little bit, but when you describe the success that Ukraine is having against the Russian military, it seemed, and it's partially because we're going to talk about the flip sides of a few things, but that does seem like our ally is now operating the way our rivals did in Iraq, Afghanistan, wow, etc. That we have essentially lost in asymmetric warfare, and now Russia's getting a taste of what that looks like.
That's exactly right. You know, we took out the fifth largest army in the world, the Iraqi army, in about 3 weeks. It was unbelievable. But months later, the insurgency surfaced, and they started doing hit and run tactics, the advent
IEDs.
Of IEDs, and all of a sudden our armored capability, which was so decisive in a standard set piece battle that we were fighting with the Iraqi tanks, became an obstacle to us. These were big, fat, slow-moving targets that could be taken out by small groups of Iraqis operating almost invisibly. That's what's happening to the Russian forces now. And you know, after this is over, there's going to be a lot of discussion about the future of warfare and what kind of weapons we're buying and whether it's worth buying these very advanced $100 million, $200 million jet fighters, these expensive tanks. You know, do you see any notice of aircraft carriers in this war? You know, right? So all these weapons that were designed for past wars, bigger, better versions of what we thought we needed from the last war, it turns out they're being taken out by, you know, man-portable drones, yep, and anti-tank weapons, yep, and things that infantry soldiers can use to take out armored tank columns. The one thing they're lacking right now is the ability to take out the artillery and the multiple rocket launchers that are devastating the cities.
Right.
Most of the destruction you're seeing on TV,
yes,
isn't
coming
from
a distance.
Exactly. Exactly. But if they get more drones, they can do that. And they can fly the drones right to the source of the artillery barrages and knock them out. I expect that we're going to see a lot more of that in the next few weeks.
Interesting. You know, I have to say that the voice in my head, as you were saying, you know, as we observe how a big army and expensive weapons are no match for nimble fighters, and so maybe now we'll learn our lesson, is sort of where that goes. But we should have learned that lesson from Iraq. We should have learned it from Vietnam, let's be true. But we should have learned it from Iraq. We should have learned it from Afghanistan. The problem, and I don't know that we can go all the way down where this tracks, but it seems to me that the problem with our military budget is not on the battlefield. It's in Congress.
Huh.
And that it's the fact that you can't, just to go back to what we're talking about, a diplomacy versus military, right? You can't place State Department money in every legislative district in the country. But you can put some sort of a weapons contract almost everywhere.
That is exactly right. I did an issue brief for Quincy on achieving a safer nuclear posture.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about what you would need to do and to reduce the number of these weapons and reduce the risk of their use. And Joe Biden is not going to do it. The nuclear posture review that the president does every term is most likely not going to make much changes at all. They're going to tweak the Trump doctrine a bit, cut a couple of minor weapons, but keep everything flowing. And the reason for that, I say, is not because this is the careful consideration of alternative nuclear policy and, you know, the kind of deliberations you would assume are being made over such weighty subjects. It's because of money. It's because of money. And it's because there's a lot of money to be made by making nuclear weapons. And there's a lot of money to be made by making tanks and jet fighters and multiple rocket launchers and Patriot air defense systems and all these very, very big, very large systems that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. You know, an aircraft carrier costs about five. No, I think the one we're building, the Gerald Ford, is coming in at $11 billion, you know, right? So that's one boat. Okay, it's a large boat, but one. And then you need destroyers.
It's even
and frigates
bigger than their yachts. You know?
And so, exactly. And so that money, you know, we got to start thinking about these nuclear weapons and about defense weapons overall as products and not the results of a carefully,
yes,
you know, construed strategy that needs these particular instruments to implement it. No, these are products, that, and it's the defense contractors are selling them the same way the tobacco industry sold cigarettes, the pharmaceutical industry sold opioids, the fossil fuel industry sells gas and oil. They know the product is no good for the customers, but they get rich doing it. And as you just said, they don't just, you know, advertise this. They have 700 lobbyists in Washington. The defense industry has 700 lobbyists in Washington, more than one for every member of Congress. And it's just overwhelming. You know, you could count the number of peace lobbyists,
yeah,
on two hands. It's just no match. And then you layer in the direct campaign contributions. You know, if you're a judge, you can't judge a case where you have a financial interest in the outcome. Members of Congress do it every day. And then the contracts that get scattered around the districts, and you realize they've really perfected this system.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is not just happenstance.
It is wired. It is almost impossible. And that's why we're getting an $800 billion defense budget. Not because we need it, not because it makes us strong, not because, you know, this is what we need to protect ourselves. It's because there is a fortune to be made in selling this equipment, and people are not going to give up that opportunity.
Yeah, and not, I would say one other not in that is not because this money couldn't be better spent,
yeah,
solving problems that beset our communities, our families, our taxpayers.
Absolutely. You know? Let me just go off on that for a second.
Go.
Just to give you some perspective. Before we started this idiotic global war on terrorism, before we invaded Iraq, before we decided that the invasion of Afghanistan had to turn into a 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, we were spending $300 billion on the Pentagon budget. That was George W. Bush's first budget, $300 billion. Okay, as I say, it's at $800 billion now, so 22 years later. And when we were spending $300 billion, we had the largest military in the world, the most capable military in the world. It wasn't like we were behind anybody or we felt particularly threatened by anybody. And then when we were faced with a terrorist threat, our answer was to conduct conventional military war, right? The things we knew how to do. And it was a disaster. It's cost us $14 trillion. We killed over 750,000 people in the Middle East, completely destabilized the order. It's going to take us decades to recover from that folly. And there's no sign that we're actually have learned the lessons. Joe Biden, you know, got so much grief for pulling out of Afghanistan. Yes, it was done clumsy. Yes, it wasn't the right way to do it. But, you know, that's considered a negative for Biden, that he's trying to end these wars. Okay. Now, what are we going to do about that? Well, Biden had promised at the beginning of his administration that he was going to reimagine national security. You can go back to the press conference in November of right after he was elected, where he introduced his national security team, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan talked about the instructions they were under from Joe Biden to reimagine national security to include not just military threats, but climate change,
yep,
pandemics, you know, racial injustice, inequity in all its forms, which is correct. That
exactly,
is the correct
exactly.
frame.
When you talk about the national security, it is not about an attack in Afghanistan or a skirmish in the Middle East. It is about these things that are, I mean, you know, climate change, pandemics, public health, the education of our youth.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. The problem is he's not, and he tried. I mean, when you look at what he did with the COVID relief package and the mm-hmm. American Rescue Plan and what he tried to do with the stupidly named Build Back Better Plan, you know, he was trying to do that,
yeah,
to shore up American democracy to compete in a world where we face real threats from autocratic governments and movements. And he was blocked from doing that by the opposition party and some turncoat members of his own party. And he was unable to do that. And he thought he could do it all. He thought he could increase military spending, which he did, plus really ramp up the domestic side of this, the climate change side of this, the pandemic side of this. It hasn't worked. And now the Ukraine war is here. And I support what he's doing. I think we are lucky to have a man like President Biden and the team he's assembled, particularly in the national intelligence field, with Bill Burns and Avril Haines leading us. They've acted judiciously, carefully, not responding to Putin's threats, for example, with threats of our own. You know, there's no replay of Donald Trump.
And done some unconventional things, like the decision to release what intelligence knew as quickly as they knew it. That was pretty unprecedented.
Exactly. And they are trying to do this, and they're trying to respond to this military invasion, not by a U.S. or NATO counteroffensive, not by going in the way some want, but by a diplomatic and economic counteroffensive, and doing it with the greatest strength we have, which is global unity. You know, we're the ones with a global alliance, and that alliance is stronger than it's ever been right now, and more people are being attracted to it. I mean, Switzerland.
Right?
These guys were neutral in the war against the Nazis. Against the Nazis.
Who were right next door.
and they're joining this fight. And you can see it might work. That because of the tenacity of the Ukrainian fighters and preventing a victory by Putin, you're giving time for these sanctions to really bite. And this is the week, actually, while we're talking, this is when you might see Russia go into default over its debt. This is a huge consequences for Russia. And the companies are pulling out. We're not making companies pull out of Russia, but over 400 companies have pulled out of, well, maybe 360 of the top 400 companies investing in Russia have pulled out.
Wow.
There's only 33 that haven't done this yet. You know, people like McDonald's and Coca-Cola, they're losing a fortune from this.
They are, right.
Putin's threatening to confiscate their stores over this and nationalize it. But it's working. And if this works the way it seems to be working, well, that, again, that's going to be another transformation of global relations. The fact that you can do this, that you think that this is all going to be determined on the battlefield, well, think again. It's going to be determined in the boardrooms and in the bank rooms. And you might be able to prevail militarily in some remote corner of the earth with a military adventure, but you're going to fail on the financial level, on the diplomatic level.
Yeah, I mean, we would be, you know, not the first and not the hundredth to point out that Putin has, through his actions, produced exactly the opposite results of what he intended, that he saw coming out of the Trump years, I think, and the rise of, autocratic fandom in Europe and so on, that now was the time to that we were weak and not unified in among the other countries, and yet by doing what he's done, he's called them to greater unity, perhaps than we've seen in a long, long time. Because, as you say, it's not just governments, it's multinational corporations, and so on. There is that silver lining, or it is a silver lining as of this moment, and holds out the possibility as we're sort of talking about, a reassessment coming out of this when it is no longer, as I said before, not necessarily completely resolved, but no longer a powder keg. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes or so. I'd like you to talk about two things that I know you have something to say about. One is that we sort of referred to, but go a little bit more, in the missed opportunities that could have changed the pathway to this moment. And then what you think we should be doing as a country. And let me just say that I'm going to put in one more caveat on what we should be doing. You said something to the effect of, you know, what Biden is doing, what Biden and his State Department are doing is working. And as you're saying that, a shudder goes through me that because of domestic politics, you know, the midterms will change something. And then the 24 campaign, which of course will start in, you know, will change more. And that the life of this healthy approach is endangered by our own domestic politics, which is a frightening thought. But the big questions are, what could we have done along the way, and what should we be doing now?
Sure. First, can you still hear me? Am I still connected
yes.
to you? Yes. Okay, good. So, and I'm going to do this briefly, right? So
yeah.
that we can go through. Okay, first, just quickly looking back, you can see that we shouldn't have expanded NATO, at least not in the way that we did. You know, NATO was designed to defend Europe against the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed, logically, and mm-hmm. the Warsaw Pact collapsed, logically we should have disbanded NATO and European Union should have taken over those kind of functions, but we didn't. I think that's largely due to bureaucratic inertia, but also the real fears of the newly liberated Eastern European countries who had centuries of concerns about Russia and didn't want to be left to fend for themselves alone. So even if you're going to do NATO and keep it and redefine it, you could have done it much better to address Russia's real concerns about this. And these were not just Putin. This was Boris Yeltsin. Mm-hmm. Said, we're moving too fast. And what are we to make of this? You moving military forces right up to Russia's borders? I mean, clearly we set the stage for a lot of what then happened in the, after the turn of the century. And the other thing that set the stage was the unbridled neoliberal, ultra-capitalist philosophies and methods that we encouraged Russia to take, which basically transferred state properties, industries, over to a handful of individuals who became rich, who became the oligarchs, and set the stage for the emergence of an autocratic strongman, i.e. Putin.
Yeah, so let me just cut in for 1 second, Joe, just to say, you know, that stage of this process, when we had our consultants over there, not so many from the government, some from the government, but many. I remember just kind of looking at that and going, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Why are we doing this? Why is this not something that is being discussed, at least, as to whether this is a good strategy?
But right.
I step back.
Right,
you know?
Right. Why didn't we have a Marshall Plan
exactly.
for Russia? Right? And you look back and you go, oh, man. What were we thinking?
Well, we were neoliberal to the hilt at the moment.
And this
so
was
took
Clinton.
A neoliberal response to that happening.
Exactly. And this was Clinton. And this was that
yep.
third way. And this was, right? And look at what it produced. I mean, I can't tell you how terrible those policies were. And some people said it at the time, but clearly in hindsight, you got to know we should not have done that. But then it gets worse, because then you have this moment where all these weapons that we built up during the Cold War, they're really the ones that, forget everything else that you might want to be correct, these are the ones that can end the planet. There's three challenges, three threats we face that have planetary consequences, and that's pandemics, climate change, and nuclear weapons.
Exactly.
You know, right? Pandemics can kill you over years. Climate change can kill you over decades. Nuclear weapons can do it in an afternoon. And there was a huge move from national security officials, Bill Perry, Sam Nunn, Henry Kissinger,
oh, yes.
Paul Nitz, etc., to say, let's get rid of these things. We don't need them anymore. And it started to make some headway, and Barack Obama came in as president and gave it poetic voice, and it met fierce resistance. Fierce resistance from Republicans, who used it to ding Democrats as being weak on defense, from the bureaucracy that didn't want to give up their contracts or their billets or their general staff positions, and then finally from Putin himself, who clung to these weapons as its last vestige of great power status, and it faltered. And we, even though we made headway in reducing the mm-hmm. arsenals, it stalled, and that's where we are now. Reductions have stalled. There's been no major arms control treaty for 12 years, and there's none in sight. And this has become accepted. And Democrats are afraid of looking weak on defense.
Yes.
So the Republicans' attacks work. And so they don't want to touch this. And now with the Ukraine war, you know what you hear in Congress? We need more weapons. We need more nuclear weapons. The generals are coming in and saying, I have the bare minimum. You know, this is something you always hear. Whenever you ask a general about how many nuclear weapons we need, they always say more. And that's what we're hearing now. Even though there's no relationship between the threats we face of, say, the use of one, two, a dozen, several hundred nuclear weapons, which would be destruction beyond history, and the thousands of weapons we already have, they always want more. So that, those things, what we did in the 90s, and the missing of our moment to eliminate nuclear weapons, those have got to stand out as the two biggest mistakes we made in our unipolar moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we've got to bring this to a close. But the point you're making now where that decisions, and we've said it a couple of times, but decisions about nuclear weapons and this bloated military budget are not based on rational strategy. They are based on domestic politics. The right takes a certain position, the left is defensive, and we end up not moving. The you end up with the folks who actually say the rational strategic things being marginalized, and the mainstream, what's accepted as mainstream opinion, becomes business as usual.
Yeah,
and it's you know.
And just horrible. Let me just talk about the politics of this.
Yep.
The politics of this for Joe Biden are very good. His approval's gone up, and you see it both in the demographics of the 18 to 29 year olds, for example. The opinion of Biden has jumped 12 percentage points. 48% of that age group now approve of Biden's performance compared to 36 before the war. And you see it in general. So the prospects have improved. Basically, because it's a recognition he is handling this about right. You know, he's doing the right thing. What's it going to look like as you get closer to the midterms? What lessons are the Democratic Party going to join from this? Well, some of them, like the centrist Dems or the more conservative Dems, want to go harder on defense. You know, want to push the defense card to show that they're tougher than Republicans on defense. If I don't know which way Biden's going to go. Is he going to, you know, if we defeat Putin in some way, if his power is lessened, is there now going to be a reconsideration of the policies that got us here and some kind of outreach to try to find a way to reduce these nuclear weapons, to reduce the risk of military conflict? Or is he going to play the card that the centrists, Democrats want him to and become the wartime president and to continue that and now bring it over to the fight against China? And so that's what's hanging in the balance for the rest of this year. And it's all going to be driven by domestic politics, not really by international pressures.
Very good. I'm glad you added that, and we'll close on that. So again, Joe Cerincione is a distinguished fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and their website is quincyinst.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles to kind of flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos' Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Joe Cerincione. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terry. It was a real pleasure.